Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The sprawling Civil War novel, Gone with the Wind, was published in 1936. Its author, Margaret Mitchell, won the Pulitzer Prize, and Hollywood jumped in big. In 1939, producer David O. Selznick released the Technicolor movie version. 70 years later, Gone with the Wind is still the top-grossing movie of all time. My guest today, film critic Molly Haskell, revisits 1860s Georgia and Scarlett and Rhett and Tara, and says it's time to look again at Gone with the Wind. This hour, On Point, a fresh look at the great old classic of the South and Civil War. You can join the conversation. Does Gone with the Wind make your list of top 5, top 10 American movies? And what does this story, this film, tell us about sexuality, slavery, our Civil War, race, our national identity? Joining me now from New York is author and film critic Molly Haskell, born in North Carolina, raised in Richmond, Virginia, and long now of New York. Martin Scorsese calls her one of the best writers on film we have. She's written on movies for many publications, made her feminist mark with her 1973 book, From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies. Her new book is, frankly, my dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. Molly Haskell, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Feels almost like some kind of American sacrilege to jabber over that Gone with the
Wind. Especially when you start that score, you just want to sort of choke up and, and sort of drown in it.
Let the Technicolor roll. All right, Southern girl, what brought you back here? Is it just bread in the bone? Or, you know, here you are deep in a long career and back with Gone with the Wind. Why?
Well, I don't think I ever would have done it on my own. I wouldn't have. It's just too complex and too difficult. But Yale University Press is doing the series, American Icons, and they came to me. Mm-hmm. And once I got into it, I thought this is in a way the book I was born to write, because it gave me a chance to sort of revisit the South. I had left Richmond many years ago, partly because it is such a conservative place and the tensions of race were still high and fraught. And so I just sort of escaped it and didn't look back. And now it was a time to look back and think of it in the context of Gone with the Wind and the way that changes. I think context is just interesting, and that's what makes films exciting, because they change with you and with the times. And so it seemed just the right time to do it.
Here's this great big film, a classic no matter how you look at it, but it's had so many different responses over the years. I mean, it is beloved, it is belittled, it is condemned for its depictions of slavery and women in Gloria Steinem called it, full bondage with the cinching up the corset scene.
Of the corset. Well, there's several ways of looking at that. One is imprisonment. The other is Scarlett is donning her battle armor to go into battle. But, I mean, in a sense, women were victims because their only vocation was marriage. That was the only choice they had. But they were fierce. They were like generals in competing and in strategizing to get a husband. So this was Scarlett in full battle mode. So I don't see her as a victim at all.
But what also, about the waves of reception that this story,
well,
book, and
gonna
film?
Say.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because in the 70s, I think we just couldn't look at it. It was a period of high sensitivity on racial issues, on feminist issues. And all we could see was stereotypes. We looked at the blacks and we saw only their position as servants or as sort of supine slaves, happy, loyal to their masters. But then a lot of people, including scholars of black cinema and black scholars, began to take a more nuanced view. After all, Hattie McDaniel had not only won the first Academy Award ever awarded to a black actor, she has is really the mainstay of the film in certain ways. I mean, she's not, of course, as prominent as Scarlett, but she really holds the film together, and she's an amazing character. I mean, she's the one person who can stand up to Scarlett, who can talk back to Scarlett, who really knows what's going on. She's a kind of idealized mammy figure. But all people could see at the time was blacks as servants. So I think now the conversation, because there has been a lot of progress in the intervening years, culminating in Obama's presidency, we can really talk about things in a freer way. Similarly with the women's issues, I think at the time the word rape just itself was just such a hot-button issue, and marital rape too. And, of course, this is not the rape. I mean, what rape is, the fear of rape, is of some anonymous person assaulting you in a dark alley, and that's not what this is at all.
You're talking Gone with the Wind and Rhett Butler carrying Scarlett up that long staircase.
Finally fed up with Scarlett, jealous of Ashley, insanely drunk, and desiring this woman as he's never desired another, taking her up the staircase. And then you have to see it also, of course, in the context of the next morning, where there she is sort of purring like a baby. She's had probably her first orgasm and deliriously happy. So this is a fantasy orchestrated by a woman. I think probably only a woman writer could have gotten away with it. It's a kind of awakening. And I think we've also come to understand that women do have perverse fantasies as well, and that fantasy is an area where censorship doesn't quite operate.
You're out there on the feminist edge operating there, Molly. So all kinds of fantasy in here, and I want to bring some of the sound of it in. We'll hear a lot more, Molly. But let me get a little tape here from early in the film, before the outbreak of the Civil War. And here's a bit where Scarlett's father, Gerald O'Hara, played by Thomas Mitchell, tells Scarlett, Vivian Leigh, of course, how important their plantation, Tara, is. In this scene, Scarlett's just learned that her beloved Ashley Wilkes will marry someone else. Her father tries to console her, telling her the land is the most important thing.
But what difference does it make who you marry, so long as he's a Southerner and thinks like you? And when I'm gone, I leave Tara to you.
I don't want Tara. Plantations don't mean anything when...
Do you mean to tell me, Katie Scarlett O'Hara, that Tara, that land doesn't mean anything to you? Why, land is the only thing in the world worth working for, worth fighting for, worth dying for, because it's the only thing that lasts.
Oh, Paul, you talk like an Irishman.
It's proud I am that I'm Irish. And don't you be forgetting, Missy, that you're half Irish, too. And to anyone with a drop of Irish blood in them, why, the land they live on is like their mother. Oh, but there. No, you're just a child. It'll come to you, this love of the land. There's no getting away from it if you're Irish.
A little Irish and a whole lot of antebellum South kicking off Gone with the Wind. Molly Haskell is with us. Her new book is Frankly, My Dear, and it's a new look. Captivating. Let's get a caller right here. Fred, Holliston, Massachusetts. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi. I spent 6 years living in the South, and I had the same argument over and over again, which is that the Civil War was not fought over slavery, that slavery was not a bad thing, that it was all okay. And I just found, I only left there, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, mm-hmm. and I find this movie more offensive than ever. I don't find anything noble in it, and I think it does perpetuate all those things, and I don't think it's time to reassess it in a more positive light.
Molly, what do you say?
Well, I agree that the self-justifying myths of the South are still current there, and I don't think I think the movie does idealize the South, and this was part of its appeal at the time. I don't believe that the plantation myth has any appeal anymore. I mean, I think certain themes of the movie fade and others emerge, and the plantation myth I don't think has much hold on anybody anymore. And I don't think, the point that Donald Bogle, a black critic, makes is, no, the movie does not show slaves in revolt. It does not show the blacks who actually joined the Union Army. Mm-hmm. But it does show black actors transcending these stereotypes and making them richer and more complex. So I think you can say that. I think the part of the problem with ideological criticism is that it casts something into the dustbin. It doesn't allow you to reassess it. And one of the problems with something like, say, blaxploitation cinema that came out in the 70s, where so many people attacked it for exploiting blacks or black stereotypes, and the genre disappeared. And so those roles were no longer available to blacks. It was a time when there really weren't very many roles for blacks on the screen. And what happened with this film, David Selznick tried very hard not to indulge in the stereotypes. He did not refer to the Ku Klux Klan by name. He was afraid he would be like Griffith, who went down in history as the racist of Birth of a Nation. Mm-hmm. So he tried, and he was very aware, as a Jew who was aware of what was going on in Europe, he was aware of the kinds of things that can happen to a minority. So he tried hard to, and he gave Hattie McDaniel a richer role than was in the book, more to do, a Butterfly McQueen ditto. I mean, it is a movie you can legitimately feel that way about, but I don't think, I think it's been reassessed by others aside from myself, because I think it's important to look at these things and to look at, this is what slavery was. I mean, this is our original sin. If anything, I think what makes people cringe is that it was slavery, that we did do it, and it wasn't that long ago.
But the criticism is that this is not what it was. There's no, you don't see the lash here. You don't, you know, there's violins and Technicolor and the kind of pretty. Fred says it's more offensive than ever.
Well, I think that's a legitimate point of view. I don't quite see it that way. But maybe it's because I've had a different picture of it.
What's the staying power source for this movie? I mean, it still has such a grip on the imagination, even among those who consider it offensive. Why?
Well, I think it has more to do with Scarlet, with just the epic suite. We've really had no Civil War movies. This is another thing, and maybe this is what strikes this listener as offensive, because there's been nothing to replace it, really. This is, I mean, things like Cold Mountain. There are a few Civil War movies, but they really haven't. They don't have anything like the sweep and the ambition of Gone with the Wind. So it really has come to stand as the Civil War story. But I think what really makes the hold is really the family, the love story and the family drama, the story of individual love and loss, and Scarlett herself as a very complex, ambiguous character. You want to strangle her 1 minute and root for her the next. She's horrible. She lies, cheats, and steals, and does terrible things. And yet, there's a kind of unstoppable spirit of independence, a ferocious individualism. I mean, that too, you can be ambivalent about. But I think that's what's made it last. There's none of the pieties of most romantic fiction.
Molly Haskell, please stand by in New York. The new book is Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind, Revisited. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new look at the great old classic of the American South and Civil War, Gone with the Wind, and a call to give Scarlett and Rhett and the gang some new respect, at least another look. Molly Haskell is with us, longtime film critic, out with a new book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind, Revisited. It's, of course, the famous scene where Scarlett is getting ready for the big party next door at 12 Oaks, and her corsets being hitched up by Mammy, played by Hattie McDonald, Scarlett by Vivian Leigh. Well, here we go.
Ooh! Just hold on and suck in.
Mammy, here's Miss Scarlett's pickles.
You can take it all back to the kitchen. I won't need a bite.
Oh, yes, and you is. You's going to eat every mouthful of this.
Oh, I'm not.
You put on the dress, because we're late already.
What my lamb going to wear?
That.
No, you ain't. You can't show your bosom before 3 o'clock. I'm going to speak to your ma about you.
If you say one word to mother, I won't eat a bite.
Vivian Leigh and Heather McDaniel, and the corset is hitched. Let's go to Kate in East Hampton, New York. Kate, you're on the air with Molly Haskell.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I've grown up watching Gone with the Wind, and when I was younger, I think it was a lot about the dresses and how beautiful she was, but as I've grown older, she's definitely served as a role model, and she's so strong, and she fought and sacrificed so much to keep Tara, and I think that it's a great movie, and I think that you can get past maybe the filmmaking of the time and see her for the strong feminist that she is.
Okay, we'll take it on board from Kate, who's 22. Let's get one more right there. Kimberly in Greenville, South Carolina. Kimberly, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ms. Haskell. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
And Ms. Haskell, let me say I enjoy your work on TCM. What I'd like to say is that in terms of role models, if you will, I feel that the only two that I would consider a role model as female role models are the women who are doing, I guess, what's perceived as being illegal or who are being demeaned. For example, the character of Belle, the madam or the prostitute. This is a woman who seems in control of her destiny. But
Rhett Butler's friend, who plays a big role in the end.
Exactly. But again, she's the only woman who appears to technically be, you know, her own business owner, but she has to sell her body to do it. She's putting her son in private school. So I think that's an interesting aspect of the film. And Mammy, who, again, many would say is very independent, et cetera, but she is still she's still a slave when it is all said and done. So I think that's an interesting aspect. The other thing that I find interesting as an African-American woman is that even though Hattie McDaniel did win the Academy Award, I don't believe she was even allowed to go to the premiere because in Atlanta, they just would not allow blacks to have that type of forum. And when I look at the movie, that's what comes to my mind. the one person to win the Academy Award couldn't even really go to the premiere, from what I understand, or at least is never shown in any of the pictures. And I understand there was a great outcry by the city of Atlanta about her even being there.
I didn't know that story. Molly Haskell, what can you tell us?
Yeah, that's in the book. Yeah, it's an outrage. She was the first person to win, and Selznick had planned to take her down, but then the people of Atlanta said they couldn't have it. If she came, she would have to be in segregated quarters. This was Jim Crow period, so she didn't come. They even had a separate program in the South that took her picture off of it.
Mm.
But I mean, it's a totally mixed bag. You have to look at it both ways. On the other hand, the blacks were treated better on the set than they had been in Birth of a Nation. Clark Gable, who was a good friend of Hattie McDaniel's, made sure that she was treated well, which is something I love. And you have that one of my favorite scenes in the film is the one where Mammy finally comes around to liking Rhett Butler. She's been mistrustful of him all the way, and suddenly, and he's given her this wonderful red petticoat, and she wouldn't wear it. And she suddenly, when she sees how much he loves his little girl child, which men aren't supposed to do, they're not supposed to love the little girls, she puts it on, and they have this scene together where Clark Gable, who never could master the Southern accent, which is probably a good thing, suddenly falls into it, and they have this wonderful rapport. So, you know, if you look at it in strict, I think, in fact, what's more offensive about the film is not so much the slavery, which is treated in a more idealized way, but is the portrait of Reconstruction, which is really ugly and bigoted and wrong. So I mean,
in that it's portrayed as just flat up disaster.
Exactly. When actually, this was a period when blacks were making strides. They were represented in state legislatures. They were being schooled, and then suddenly there was an about face on the part of the South, who were terrified because, especially in these deep South states, they were outnumbered by blacks, and there was a complete repression. But so there's none of that sense of progress, and if anything, this is just a real violent. And one of the cagey things that Mitchell does is she puts these words of abuse in Hattie McDaniel's mouth. She's the one that can't stand the carpetbagger. So, you know, that's a very cagey way of doing it.
Yes, it is.
But this was sort of the portrait of Reconstruction that held sway even among historians at the time and has been revised in recent years by historians like Eric Foner. So there's definitely a lot to love and hate in the movie, I think.
We do have tape of Hattie McDaniel, who played Mammy, acceptance speech, accepting her Academy Award. This is February 1940.
This is one of the happiest moments of my life, and I want to thank each one of you who had a part in selecting me for one of the awards. For your kindness, it has made me feel very, very humble. And I shall always hold it as a beacon for anything that I may be able to do in the future. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you. God bless you.
Hattie McDaniel with her Oscar in 1940. Of course, America gave it to her for playing Mammy. Alice is calling from Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'm 93 and blind, and right now I'm listening to Gone with the Wind on a talking book.
Uh-huh.
And it's so beautifully written, and I remember the excitement we had when we first saw that four-hour movie. But my comment is that I think what's happening to us today shows how far we've come as a country since then, and I think the book and movie made a contribution to that. Thank you.
Alice, thank you very much for calling and for that perspective. I appreciate it.
And it's true. They did actually it began a conversation in Hollywood. They passed a code that they would try to have better and more and better roles for blacks after that.
I want to bring in another voice here, if I may, Molly, from Los Angeles. We're joined by Karen Grigsby Bates. NPR listeners will know her as the NPR correspondent based in Los Angeles. Karen Grigsby Bates, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Molly.
Can I just say one
please,
thing?
Yeah.
This is so funny because you're in the book, Karen, not by name, but somebody sent a link to the conversation you had with other black women on NPR about Gone with the Wind and your response to it, and I included it. It's on page 20 in the book.
There you
oh,
are,
wow.
Not named.
So I have to go back and look.
Now the truth is known. Karen,
you
did a year ago or so have this commentary on NPR when you talked about growing up and your attitude in a mixed race house toward...
No. We were all completely black.
Okay. but your attitude towards Scarlett O'Hara then in a completely black house. Take us into that.
Well, I grew up in Connecticut in a little town called New Haven.
We've heard of it.
And I grew up, I always like to say that I'm sort of the geographic equivalent of being biracial because my dad was an unreconstructed Yankee, but black.
I guess that's what I picked up on. Okay.
And my mom grew up in what she considered a much more genteel environment. She's from Charlotte, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so there was always this sort of bifurcated vision of a lot of things based on the cultural prism through which both my parents focused things to the mm-hmm. point that, you know, my dad didn't travel south very much unless there were momentous occasions, you know, my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary, that kind of stuff, because he just thought it was completely benighted and, you know, it's segregated down there. What are you talking about? My mother, on the other hand, after my dad died, stayed in Connecticut for about a year and then returned south because she thought it was a much more civilized way to live. And she had grown up in a segregated household. And so when I'd never seen or heard anything about Gone with the Wind. I'd never heard, you know, I don't know nothing about Birth and No Babies and none of that. Because my mother had seen it when she was in college. It came along as sort of a, you know, every 10-year revival or something. They looked at it and thought, and didn't look at it again. She'd never brought the book home, none of that. I stumbled upon it myself. It had this lurid sort of red and gold and black cover. It's Rhett with Scarlett in his arms with Atlanta burning in the background.
Course,
you know, and to
yeah.
a 15-year-old girl, I was like, yeah, let's take a look at that. So I did, and I think in the first couple of pages, I just totally fell in love. I did not see the movie until 10 years after that, and frankly, my dear, I found the book way more interesting.
You quote Terry McMillan, speaking of Scarlett O'Hara, you quote her in your NPR commentary saying, I love the little hussy. Terry McMillan. And you say that you've run across that not just with Terry, but with other black women in your life who have a fondness.
Well, it's interesting. There's this sort of, I thought I was the only one. And I think my mother looked at me as if I were daft. She said, you do understand they're talking about slavery, don't you? You do understand where you come from, don't you? And it's like,
Heads up.
I get it. You know, I visited the graves. I know how this works, mother. But still, it's, you know, it's a great drama, a really melodrama. And you have to look at it on two levels. You know, on the one hand, it's great entertainment. On the other hand, you know it's been manipulated and massaged and a whole bunch of other things, but it's still great entertainment.
Let's get a call.
So that there were black women my age whose mothers had not exposed them to the book for the same reason my mother didn't, I think. And
serious reasons in their own regard. I mean,
it was too sexy. You know? Well, yeah. That's what most mothers thought.
It wasn't even the sex. It was we'd gotten beyond that, you know, at that point. You know, I think I read Peyton Place before I read Gone with the Wind. So I don't think that was the problem. But I think it was painful for black women of my mother's age to deal with the notion of white privilege among their female peers.
Yeah.
And I think that you see that later on. I mean, I'm old enough. I went to college in the 70s when the feminist movement was relatively nascent. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of discussion at that point about why can't black women come on board? Why can't black women come on board? And white women at the time did not understand that there was this membrane of privilege, whether you were a black debutante or whether you were, you know, the subway conductor's daughter in school, between white women and how they saw the world and their black peers. I think that's better understood, although not always accepted now. But I think it's something that you feel a little bit, you know, in this book, that on the one hand, we do revere Scarlett because she doesn't roll over and submit to the cultural oppression of the day. You know, that whole mm-hmm. negotiation with Mammy about, oh, no, you isn't. You're going to eat every mm-hmm. bite. They had to negotiate that. They had to finesse that because Mammy was basically the person who knew Scarlett best, who knew her better than her parents, who spent more time with her.
But Scarlett was the master's daughter and Mammy was a slave.
Mammy was a slave, but Mammy also, in the context of the movie and the book, had been sort of sexually neutered. So she wasn't she wasn't Sally Hemings. So Gerald O'Hara wasn't looking at her going, "Mammy, let's have a little roll in the hay once you get the wheat ones in the
bed." No, not that. Not here. Let me invite in Brenda from Buffalo, New York. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi. I really just wanted to say that I think the movie and the book should be relegated to the garbage heap of history. I read it when I was a kid like everybody else. I've seen the movie 50 million times. And as an African-American woman, I've never been able to get past how offensive it is and how it's just added to the whole glorification of the South and the South's goals and the Civil War. The South lost, okay? Mm-hmm. But unlike any other defeated adversary, somehow they managed to make it look like it was a win, okay? Blacks, after the Civil War, went through 100 years
of pain,
lynchings, of beatings, mm-hmm. of being denied their vote, of being treated worse than the bottom of, you know, what's on the bottom of your shoe.
Yep.
And they were supposed to have lost. So the only thing I can say is get over it, okay? I would much rather see someone with Miss Haskell's talent spending their time writing and thinking about something else. Scarlett O'Hara,
But Brenda, thank you very much for your call. Molly Haskell, Brenda's ready for it to go to the dust heap.
Well, that's a legitimate feeling. I think all of these are legitimate. My one question is why you saw it so often.
It's hard to avoid. It's on cable all the time.
Well, no, wait a minute. You can turn it off.
That's true.
And also, the other thing I would say is the losers are always the ones that are enshrined, the noble losers. And that's one thing that Margaret Mitchell did not buy into, the sort of myth of the South as noble losers. This is one of the interesting things about Scarlett. Of course, she's responding as a spoiled teenager, this war. It's just nonsense. It's taking away all her pleasures. But also, she just sees there's something ridiculous about these men being enshrined as patriotic heroes and going off to war. She doesn't have time for that. So, I mean, there is both an anti-war and an anti-Southern mystique aspect to Scarlett. Mm-hmm.
Karen, your response to Brenda in Buffalo?
You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that we probably would be better focusing our energy on other things. But I think Scarlett is a legitimate part of the American imagination. Because it glorifies a part in history that, as the introduction to the movie says, will never come again, and didn't really exist in the first place. And that's probably the danger in it, and that's probably part of what Brenda was objecting to, that there was never this glorious, noble South that the movie showed. There was a lot of meanness, a lot of oppression, a lot of violence, and a lot
There's
of
There's also a white,
hate.
Another white culture that is not shown here, too, a working white culture. Yeah.
Well, there was a little bit of it shown in the movie. Remember, Emmy Slattery used to be
sort of poor white trash.
You trash, get off my front steps, you killed my mother. So they showed the resentment of the non-plantation-owning South. And by the way, most of the white South didn't own plantations.
No,
there were
it's
lots
a small
of
percentage.
White folks that didn't own slaves because they couldn't. They couldn't afford it. And that's where part of the Reconstruction violence came in, because you saw all of a sudden black people making strides and white
and
folks, poor white
yeah.
folks feeling left behind
yep.
and being very worried about that.
Karen Grigsby-Bates with NPR in Los Angeles. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for jumping in with us for a few minutes. Appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new look at the great old classic of the American South and Civil War, Gone with the Wind. Molly Haskell is with us, longtime writer, film critic, author of the new book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. She is very aware of all the ways in which this film has been received over time. What stands is that it's what's still the biggest, most seen, the biggest box office in American history Molly's book really brings a lot back. It brings a lot that I hadn't known before about the film. We'll talk about the big characters who got it made. Let's listen for just a minute here. Here's the portion where the Yankees have moved in on Atlanta, and Scarlett convinces Rhett Butler, Clark Gable, to take her and Prissy and Melanie and Melanie's newborn baby back to the plantation, Tara. Rhett takes her as far as the turnoff to Tara. Then he decides he's going to join up with the Confederate forces, leaving Scarlett to drive the wagon on. There's a heated exchange after Rhett announces he's going to leave.
You should die of shame to leave me here alone and helpless.
You helpless? Heaven help the Yankees if they capture you. Now, climb down here. I want to say goodbye.
No.
Climb down.
Oh, Rhett, please don't go. You can't leave me, please. I'll never forgive you.
I'm not asking you to forgive me. I'll never understand or forgive myself. And if a bullet gets me, so help me, I'll laugh at myself for being an idiot. There's one thing I do know, and that is that I love you, Scarlett. In spite of you and me and the whole silly world going to pieces around us, I love you. Because we're alike, bad lots, both of us. Selfish and shrewd, but able to look things in the eyes and call them by their right names.
Don't hold me like that.
Scarlett, look at me. I love you more than I've ever loved any woman. And I've waited longer for you than I've ever waited for any woman.
Let me alone!
Here's a soldier of the South who loves you, Scarlett. Wants to feel your arms around him. Wants to carry the memory of your kisses into battle with him. Never mind about loving me. You're a woman sending a soldier to his death with a beautiful memory. Scarlett, kiss me. Kiss me once.
Scarlett and Rhett, Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh on the road back to Tara, there from Gone with the Wind. Molly Haskell, as Karen left us, she asked us to be reminded of two things in the sort of keeping it real category. One, that at those Oscars where we heard Hattie McDaniel give her speech, she sat at a segregated table, and upon her death, buried in a segregated cemetery, only reburied out of there quite recently.
It's important to keep all these negative things in mind. I think I understand the people's objection to the film in the sense that it allows the South to continue to whitewash itself. But at the same time, I think it's important to get the information out and to think critically about it, and it's in the good and the bad of it.
You point at Margaret Mitchell, Vivian Leigh, and David O. Selznick, the producer himself, and their particular characters as the big drivers of what the film became. And I wish you'd give us a little bit of that analysis, Molly.
Well, I think they were all driven in similar ways, and in fact, they were all a little bit manic depressive. In fact, Vivian Leigh was diagnosed later as a manic depressive. Margaret Mitchell so described herself in letters, and Selznick was a complete maniac. He was up all night on Benny's and peanut butter. Mm. So they were all driven people, and I think this is what made it the coming together of these three. Of course, Margaret Mitchell never went to Hollywood. She wouldn't get near Hollywood. She was afraid that they would create a film that would embarrass her among the good folks of Atlanta. So she stayed home, but she had a spy on the set telling her what was going on, a woman who was there to vet them and make sure the etiquette was proper and all that. Vivian Leigh campaigned for the part. She paid her own way to Hollywood, got Myron Selznick, David Selznick's brother and agent of her lover, Laurence Olivier.
Mm-hmm.
She was British, and she read the book and knew she just felt she was right for the part. So it wasn't one of these situations where David Selznick discovered her, even though thousands of women were campaigning for the part. Myron presented her to David Selznick. They'd already begun shooting the film. It was a scene of the leaving of Atlanta, the burning Atlanta. Mm. They had doubles in there, and suddenly there Vivian Leigh was, her green eyes blazing in the firelight, and he knew he had his Scarlett. And she was driven. She worked much harder than anyone. She was on screen almost the whole time and was really feverish by the end, not only from overwork, but also because she was dying to get back to Olivia, whom she loved with just a mad passion. There was a funny story in the end. She had to, the opening scene had to be reshot, and she was too tired and haggard looking at the end to reshoot it. So finally, Selznick sent her off for a weekend of love with Larry Olivier, and she came back looking fresh and virginal, and they shot the first scene. And so it was these people, and David Selznick was obsessional about details, particularly women's dress. He was one of these producers who really loved women, and he wrote Margaret Mitchell that he couldn't figure out how to tie the bandana on Hattie McDaniel's head, and Margaret Mitchell wrote back, "Well, I don't want to get into a twit about a head rag." You know, she just wouldn't have anything to do with it. But that was the way Selznick was. Just he drove people crazy. He fired one director, George Cukor, and hired another, Victor Fleming, and it shouldn't have worked. There were just too many cooks, but somehow it did. All these different sort of brilliant craftsmen came together, and I think part of it is that score, that very lush Max Steiner score, the look of the film, there's a continuity there, so somehow it did.
Did these three see themselves, I don't know if Vivian Lee even thought about it, maybe she did, but did they see themselves as glorifying the antebellum South or something else? What was the mission that they were setting out on? I guess Margaret's would have been her own, but...
Well, you've just got to remember, this book came out in 1936. Mm-hmm. One of the things we haven't touched on maybe later is how everyone saw it as a Depression fable. Margaret Mitchell wrote it in the 20s out of her kind of jazz age rebellion. Scarlett was really a jazz age rebel in antebellum clothing. But in 1936, it was the Depression. Macmillan had to raise the price of the book to $3 because it was such a long book, and Margaret Mitchell couldn't believe people would pay that kind of money for a book in the Depression. And so, but when they were in the movie, it sold 3,700 copies a week, the book was, and nothing had ever happened like that before. So people just saw it. Well, one of the interesting things is they'd been making a lot of Civil War movies in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. It was one of the things that the moguls, it was sort of their way of reinventing. This was a lot of the idealization came from these early Civil War films, mm-hmm. because these Jewish moguls saw in the South a way of kind of idealizing and whitewashing their own past, creating a new American history and focusing on the family, which was, of course, a strong thing for them. So these Civil War films were there. Then suddenly the business had fallen off. The latest Civil War film, So Red the Rose, had done no box office. So the studios weren't that interested in it. It took David Selznick, an independent producer who was driven, to bring it to the screen. And when they were making it, everybody was getting sick of it. David Selznick conducted the search for Scarlett in public. He had all these, you know, the gossip columns. Every day there would be something about who was trying out for it now. People coming from all over wanting the role and conducting the search in the South, here, there, and everywhere. So the press was sick of it, and the columnists were second-guessing Selznick. And they were making it. I think they were sick of it when they were making it. So I think they weren't thinking of it as – they thought of it as what really it is, above and on. This is why everybody sees it, and even when they don't want to like it. It's just a story fabulously well told. Mm. I mean, you look at something like Australia trying to do an epic and also do a love story and how hard it is.
Yes, indeed.
And this is, I think it was and you have these wonderful characters in the foreground, and also the subordinate characters are very strong and vivid.
And you remind us, all this coming up in the Depression years, in here, a story of rising up out of poverty and destruction. Here's that little clip, the famous scene, after returning to Terra, finding it in ruins. Scarlett is out in the garden and... big red sunset behind her, and she's vowing never to be defeated.
God is my witness. As God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. If I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
Never again, and the music swells and swells and swells. Nancy, in Lexington, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is really a fascinating topic, and I guess I called in with one question and then thought of another.
Okay.
My first question is, first of all, I've read this book more times than I've cared to admit and seen the movie more times than I've cared to admit. I know all those clips by heart. But you look at Scarlett, she is a reprehensible character. She lies, she cheats, she steals, she does her family wrong, she takes her sister's fiancé away from her, she sells bad lumber, she marries men she doesn't love. She's awful. At the same time, you have Melanie, who is upright, she's honorable, she defends the old guard, she's fabulous. course, at the end of the story in the movie, Melanie dies and Scarlett goes on to procrastinate another day. What do you, why would anybody like Scarlett? And when you put Melanie and Scarlett together, maybe you have some ideal of womanhood? And my second question is, when the movie came out, were people, how did people respond who read the book to the movie that, you know, couldn't cover everything in the book, just as no movie can cover all of any epic book. But a lot's left out. You know, in the book, Scarlett has three children. In the movie, she doesn't have, she has the one child by Rhett, but in the book, she has two children previously by Charles and by Frank.
It's not a carbon copy of the book. We'll look at that as well. Molly Haskell, feminist Haskell, what do you say first about Scarlett and
Melanie?
Let me start with the last first.
It's fresh on my mind. It's a good thing you don't have those other children in the movie, because Scarlett is a terrible, I mean, to add to her list of grievances and sins, she's the worst mother going. She drinks while she's pregnant. I mean, then she just disregards the two children and expects other people to take care of them. And this is one of the very sort of anti-romantic aspects of Mitchell. But I think she would have been much more unsympathetic if they'd thrown those in. There are other really interesting characters that don't get into the movie, other blacks and women. But I think most people understood that you couldn't have all that in. And also, sure, the public was in on the casting. They felt that they were responsible for getting Clark Gable in there and all the people. So they had been consulted. David Selznick had this love affair with the public and sort of brought them in on everything. And I think you make a very good point about Scarlett versus Melanie, but you have to see that clip. Her ruthlessness and her selfishness are finally, after the war, on behalf of something beyond her, which is to save Tara and to save the people on it. So I think that's one thing. Another is that the people we admire love her, which allows us to forgive her in a way. The fact that Melanie sticks with her through thick and thin, people with moral authority like Mammy and Melanie are devoted to Scarlett. When I saw it, maybe this before you did, but it was just beginning. It was the 50s, and there was a sense of rebellion. The women's movement hadn't yet come into being, but the idea of a lady had suddenly fallen in sort of into disrepute. So Melanie was just too goody-goody. Now I think Melanie looks more interesting than I did at the time. But then it was Scarlett. We were adolescents, and so was she. And I think that was it. She is stuck. If there's one sort of defining characteristic, she is stuck in adolescence. She is stuck in her own sort of ever-present narcissism and greed and self-interest. But that's what we were as adolescents. So I think in a way we come away both forgiving and a little ashamed of her, as we do of our own selves as adolescents.
I turned your book over, and I guess I should have known, but I mean, Olivia de Havilland's still alive and blurbing your book. She's 92 years old and still...
Well, that's the interesting thing. Scarlett is a survivor in the movie, but the lady
Melanie
is a survivor in real life.
That's amazing. David in Coosahatchee, South Carolina. David, you're on the air with Molly Haskell.
Tom, how you doing?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, y'all have spoke of the meanness, the violence, and the oppression of the South. I've seen the movie several times, and to me what it clearly shows is the history, and that is the arson, the theft, and terrorism of Sherman and the Union Army.
He wanted to cut a swath to the sea, and he did, and it was full of destruction.
And, well, it wasn't only destruction, it was the theft of anything, any personal property, and haul back in wagons to the north, and I don't know of any other army that would do this, and to burn churches, just randomly burn. In our county, only two churches survived Sherman's wrath, and no army burns a church, not even today.
David, our time is short, but Molly Haskell, you hear David in Coosahatchee rising to that angle portrayed in the film.
Well, of course, the South, there are people not still around who remember it, but having been told the story, I remember it so vividly. The devastation was complete. This is another reason people responded to and sided with the South in it, because of the devastation of the Depression. They identified with that. And this was a depression, although they didn't call it that at the time. The South lost its means of support. It lost its railways. It lost its jobs. It lost Everything. And I think you do. That's pretty obvious, I think. Everybody does see that in the movie.
Molly, what's your prediction for this film? Here we are now, after 70 years, on the other side of the Civil Rights Movement, Barack Obama in the White House, the film still out there and still very widely watched when very few are from 1939 at this point. Where does this go? Does it eventually sink under the waves, or does this?
I don't think so. You can see the intensity of the responses today and across the spectrum. I think that's it's kind of wonderful and interesting. And I think, as I say, some themes fade and others reemerge. And the depression theme, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I think young people have been so. This is typical of a period of abundance and excess that they're just completely like Scarlett. They're wrapped up in their own lives, and then suddenly there's a crash, and you begin to look around and back. I think people look back in history to see how people did it then, which is the way people in 1939 were looking at it. And now again, it may have this kind of cyclical resonance of a depression.
Do you think Margaret Mitchell would be surprised that a book in movie form is still so alive, and in book form for that matter? We had Alice still listening away in Buffalo.
I don't know. I think she always professed to be surprised at everything, and yet somehow I think she knew what was coming, or at least partly, because she took so long to finish the book. She finished it, and then she kept dithering and dithering. She didn't want to let it go. I think she knew she had something huge on her hands, and she was a little bit afraid of it.
Well, Molly Haskell, it's a pleasure talking with you, and we're grateful to you for looking at this once more. Love it or hate it, it sits there enormous in our national cultural movie history. Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for the new book.
Well, thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Molly Haskell, author of Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind, Revisited. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.